Truthseekers, Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. Yeah, we were gone last night, so you got a double treat. You got to hear Tuesday's program twice. The reason we were gone was because Molly won a photography award. Ah, okay. A lot of speculation, right? Where's Malloy? Oh, my God. That's all it was, and we wanted to go attend the ceremony. Not bad for a six-year-old. Hey, we're getting very close. We're, what, 12, 14 days away from, 12 days away from election. And I've reached that point where I really don't care how anyone votes. And in a broader sense, I don't really care anymore whether a person votes or not. But if you are going to participate in what's left of our electoral system, there's a couple things you need to know, and I'm going to try to cover some of that tonight. First of all, I want to back up to the Troubled Assets Relief Program. Is that what it was called? TARP? Where have I got it here? Yeah, Troubled Asset Relief Program. It was a program that the government used to purchase assets and equity from financial institutions to strengthen the financial sector of this country. It was signed into law by Bush on October 3rd, 2008. It's the largest component of the government's measures in 2008 to address the subprime mortgage crisis. Now, originally, the Troubled Asset Relief Program was expected to cost the government, that means the taxpayers, $350 billion. As of 2 weeks ago, the most recent final net estimate of the cost to U.S. taxpayers will be close to $30 billion. That's less than one-tenth of what the original estimated cost was going to be. Now, that includes expected returns from interest in AIG. And as Wikipedia reports, this is significantly less than the taxpayer cost of the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s, which Pappy Bush set up. The cost of that crisis amounted to 3.2% of gross domestic product in the country during the Reagan-Bush era. The GDP percentage of the current crisis cost is estimated at less than 1%. About one-fourth the cost of what we went through thanks to Reagan-Bush in the 80s. Now, why Democrats and the national media are not talking about this more, I don't know. And as Wikipedia says, while it was once feared the government would be holding companies like GM and AIG and Citigroup for several years, those companies are preparing to buy back the Treasury stake and emerge from TARP within a year. Of the $245 billion invested in U.S. banks, over $169 billion has been paid back, including $13.7 billion in dividends, interest, and other income. Yada, yada, yada. The Troubled Asset Relief Program, I heard today, has generated about $25 billion in earnings for the U.S. Treasury Department. That would be us taxpayers. That's an 8.2% return on our investment in 2 years. 2 years. 8.2% return. Now, that's better than you're going to get in Treasury bonds. It's better than you're going to get the way the stock market. Well, if you hold certain stocks, you probably did better than that. But the reason I bring this up is because of the lies that these right-wing murderers are putting out there. The morons, the crazy people, people like the old lady at the end of the street with the dead cats in her basement, Sharon Angle, and the wannabe porn star from Alaska, Palin, and this moronic looking woman from Delaware. I mean, this is, it's madness. About 3 weeks ago, in the New York Times, there was a headline that said, TARP bailout to cost less than once anticipated. Now, I missed this story altogether. Maybe you did, too. The Times said, even as voters rage and candidates put up ads against government bailouts, the reviled mother of them all, TARP, the $700 billion lifeline to banks, insurance, and auto companies, will expire after Sunday. This was back towards the end of September, the 1st of October, at a fraction of the cost, and could conceivably earn taxpayers a profit. Now, this was reported by the New York Times 3 weeks ago. And since then, it has shown a profit. The Times says a final accounting of the government's full range of interventions in the economy, including the bailouts of the mortgage finance giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, is years off and will most likely remain controversial and potentially costly. But the once unthinkable possibility that the $700 billion TARP program could end up costing far less or even nothing became more likely 3 weeks ago when this was reported, with the news that the government had negotiated a plan with American International Group, AIG, to begin repaying taxpayers. Now, I remember mentioning that, but just in passing, I so much of this stuff, maybe this happens to you too, it just goes zoom right over my head. The rescue, the Times went on, of the troubled insurer, AIG, included $70 billion from the bailout program that was enacted 2 years ago. 2 years ago. Obama. At the height of the global financial crisis, late in the Bush administration. Initially to prop up big banks. All right. It was signed into law, yes, during Bush. But right before Obama was sworn in. The projected losses of all of this money's been spent are now projected to be less than $50 billion at most. Yet neither the White House nor congressional Democrats are likely to talk about this before the midterm elections. Why? Because for most voters, most of us are too stupid to figure this stuff out or even listen to somebody explain it. And TARP remains a four-letter word, right? The chief financial economist in the United States for IHS Global Insight, while critical of parts of the TARP bill, called the program overall, quote, a tremendous success. He went on to say, now, obviously, they, Democrats, can't go out on the campaign trail and say that because certainly, for a lot of voters, it's just not going to resonate, end quote. Well, no, of course it won't, because a lot of us are still unemployed. A lot of us are still dealing with underwater mortgages. A lot of us have been so thoroughly brainwashed by these campaign ads that these filthy, lying, goddamn Republicans continue to put out, that we wouldn't know the truth if it came up and bit us on the ass. But here's the truth. Now, after supporting TARP, several Republicans have lost elections, largely because of those votes. The teabaggers, these moronic sons of bitches who are, we want our country back from the Negro. Ah, too much spending, except on my stuff. Ah, well, the bank bailout, which I don't understand a thing about, you see. They laid that on in the primaries on Republicans. I don't care for Republicans at all. I mean, I hope they all choke on their own phoniness, but there were some Republicans that were defeated by these Tea Party bastards because the Tea Party bastards lied. We'll be right back.
the voice inside your head. It's Mike Malloy.
It is 21 past the hour. The only reason I'm going over this, I am not making a case here for the salvation of capitalism. I like to see capitalism crash and burn for once and for all. The point I'm trying to make is that the lies that are out there, the teabag morons do not want capitalism to crash and burn because they are owned. They are the slaves to the capitalist masters who instruct them, as stupid and ignorant as every single one of them is, to get out there and say what their masters tell them to say. Again, frankly, I'd like to see capitalism just explode. And in place of it, a form of a social democracy, or if you can stand the phrase, democratic socialism, that would make sense, not this garbage that is eating the country alive. So that's not my point here in going over this fact that the troubled asset relief program is going to cost less than once anticipated. What I'm trying to do here is to show anyone who gives a damn anymore that the lies being put out there by the teabag freaks are nothing but lies. That's all. That's all it is. Fewer than 10 Americans said they believe the program is necessary to prevent the financial industry from failing and drastically hurting the U.S. economy. That's according to a poll in July for Bloomberg. About 2.5, if you want to use statistics, 2.5 out of 10. That means the lies and distortions put out there by media, wall-to-wall coverage, succeeded. It succeeded in completely reversing what the truth was. And Republicans who supported the bailout, a lot of them lost elections because of their vote. A former investment banker now associated with the Brookings Institution in Washington think tank, Douglas Elliott said, quote, "This is the best federal program of any real size to be despised by the public like this." He says it was probably the only effective method available to us to keep from having a financial meltdown much worse than we actually had. Had that happened, unemployment would be substantially higher than it is now. The deficit would have gone up even more than it has. But it really cuts against the grain for a public that is so angry at banks to think that something that so plainly helped the banks could also be good for the public," end quote. And I have to admit of falling into that trap also. The Treasury never tapped the full $700 billion. It committed $470 billion and has dispersed $387 billion, mostly to hundreds of banks, and later to AIG, the car industry, General Motors, GMAC, and to what is so far a failed effort to help homeowners in with foreclosures, avoid foreclosures. There is so much that could have been done for us little people, but the decision was made since we live in a capitalist society, and this is where the problem comes in. You see, if you live in a capitalist society, then If it starts to crash and burn and you want to save it, where do you put the money? Do you put the money with me if I'm losing my house? Do you put it with me if I can't afford a car payment? No. You put it with the banks and the lending institutions that caused the problem. I'm not denying the predatory bastards caused the problem. Like I said, I would like to see capitalism disappear from the face of the earth. But until it does, until Americans and people around the globe are willing to allow themselves to be beaten into a bloody mass because of this filthy economic system, then when the system starts to fail, you have to put the money where the system is working, and that is where the system originates, and that's in the financial and banking and lending and insurance industries. Now, to me, the solution would have been let the whole damn thing collapse, and that would have meant an awful lot of people would have been hurt deeply. So capitalism has us over a barrel. If we don't save its ass every time it does this, then we wind up destitute. No food distribution, no energy distribution, no transportation, no nothing. So capitalism has us caught But as long as we're caught, if the money's going to go to save the system, which allegedly will save us, then where do you suppose the money has to go? Senator Bob Bennett of Utah, a lot of the teabaggers called him Bailout Bob, and he didn't get renominated for a fourth term. This is what he said. Quote, for those who are screaming at me, and screaming was the operative word, you've just saddled our children, grandchildren, $700 billion. And I said, no, I haven't. My career is over, but I do hope that we can get the word out that TARP, number one, did save the world from a financial meltdown, and number two, did so in a manner that I believe won't cost the taxpayer anything. And even if it did not all get paid back, it was still the thing to do. End quote. Bob Bennett, a Republican. Now, again, I would just as soon see capitalism die. Just die. So that humanity could live. We'll be back in a moment.
Seekers, gather round the campfire. It's More Mike Malloy.
It is 25 before the hour. Now, this would be appropriate time to bring in Prairie 2's missive for tonight, our economic affairs correspondent to the program. And he'll be talking here about capitalism, not about the troubled assets relief program that I was just talking about a moment ago based on the New York Times article from 3 weeks ago. This is about the filth of capitalism. Prairie 2 writes, last week's unemployment claims were down, and this caused Treasury bond prices to drop and their interest rate to climb, as if we were suddenly on the way to a booming economy. Unemployment is still at levels that would have been scandalous at any time since the Great Depression, but we live in a different century. The wild swings in bond prices are not about the chances that you'll have a job tomorrow, but whether or not the Federal Reserve will print a lot of new money. Goldman Sachs has issued its opinion on the matter, and they often get their way in the world. They would like to see the Fed print $100 billion a month for 6 months or so. It's being reported that others with influence on the Fed board want to see $1 trillion produced all at once in a sort of shock and awe approach to quantitative easing, that is, the buying up of various debt instruments, in this case, Treasury bonds. The Fed did this 2 years ago when they purchased $1.7 trillion in bonds and commercial debt. This doesn't include the Fed making trillions in loans to the big banks at zero interest. All of this funny money was to reinflate the money supply that was in danger of vanishing after the realization that all of Wall Street's fancy new unregulated investment instruments were rotten to the core. The wealthy class nearly became the new poor. Well, not really, since the Fed can just print more money and bail them all out. This new round of money creation has caught the attention of China, who holds more cash, more dollars than anybody. If you put all their foreign currency in one place, in actual cash, it would look like Scrooge McDuck's money bin. So their reaction is now to encourage, read order, their people to go out into the world and expand their holdings. In terms of capitalization and profits, the three biggest banks in the world are Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, China Construction Bank, and Agricultural Bank of China. The last time they tried this to go out and expand their holdings was in 2007 when they attempted large-scale mergers and acquisitions and they lost money hand over fist with the plunge in asset prices in 2008. Remember when everything started to go to hell, really to hell? This time, they're banking on inflation instead of deflation. I'm not sure they grasp, Prairie Two writes, how much bad debt still exists on the books of American companies. Or maybe they don't care. The Chinese might simply view dollars as purely expendable. All of the trillions of junk bonds, trillions of dollars of bad commercial paper, and trillions of dollars in bad mortgages still need to be dealt with before the U.S. dollar is anything but a bad joke. The Chinese curse about wishing your enemy to live in interesting times comes to mind. How this all works out will be interesting to say the least. Prairie 2. PrairieNumeral2.com is his website. Ginny Thomas, in my opinion, an obvious alcoholic and wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, as you know, was in the news the past couple of days. God damn, what a psycho. Why is there anybody left on the right that isn't insane? Anybody? I don't think so. Anyway, got an email from Kawaii John, who says, impeach Clarence Thomas. I just called my four senators to ask them to call for Thomas's impeachment. In parentheses, he writes, he's got four because he knows how to claim the right zip codes. Number one, Thomas decided on the Citizens United case. Number two, his wife received $500,000 because of that decision. Number three, impeachment is for, quote, high crimes and misdemeanors, end quote. I'm confident, John writes, that acceptance of a bribe is a high crime. You might just suggest to your audience that they call their senators. All four of them, eh, John? Not a bad idea. But I can tell you right now that the chances of Clarence Thomas being impeached are the same as the chances of Earl Warren being impeached during all those years. Who? Earl Warren. An Eisenhower appointee? Earl Warren? Conservative? Former governor of California? Turned out to be one of the more... He was interpreted as being liberal. He wasn't. He was just being commonsensical. Just. He did what a judge is supposed to. Never mind. Hell with it. I don't know if the public is waking up to what the Citizens United ruling was all about. In the first place, you know how many citizens were involved in Citizens United? What, three? Two? But the flood of anonymous money into what's left of our dying political system has been astonishing. And by a ratio of 7-1, it's going to Republicans and these bagger bastards. Scott Galindis, who is one of the co-founders of truthout.org, and he also now he is a political director of the website Reader Supported News. He writes, on November 2nd, Americans who will be going to the polls in a very important election, despite what the Republican Party and their misinformed followers in the Tea Party tell you, Obama is not on the ballot. No matter who wins in November, Scott writes, Barack Obama will still be the president. We'll still be a nation at war. We'll still have high unemployment. Millions of Americans will still be losing their homes. Bigotry based on race, religion, ethnicity, gender, and sexual orientation will still divide us. On November 4th, 2008, millions of Americans rejoiced at the election of our nation's first African-American president. But below the surface, a racist segment didn't share in our joy. Instead, a fuse was lit that led to the ugly political climate that we now face. Let's face the ugly truth. It's not the policies of Obama that fuel much of the hate directed at him. It's the color of his skin. 2 years ago, a majority of Americans rejected racism at the polls, and we should be proud of that. In just under 2 weeks, the so-called insurgents, what to me, not Scott, but to me, are direct descendants of the Klan. The only thing missing from these bastards are the hoods. The insurgents, so-called, will attempt to turn the clock back and return us to an America ruled by fear. I intend, Scott writes, to use the word insurgent in the same negative way that the warmongers use it to describe Iraqi and Afghan people resisting change in their country. They, too, believe they're doing the right thing. The insurgents in Iraq and Afghanistan are fueled by strongly held beliefs that are not that different from those who believe Obama is a Muslim or is not an American. Thank God, or whatever higher power you believe in, they have not resulted resulted to violence to achieve their goals. While many of us are disappointed at the pace of change, it's not an excuse for staying home and letting the forces of hate win this November. The insurgents, these Republican pigs, and the leashed Tea Party morons, lashed by corporate America, capitalist America, the insurgents will not end the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan. The wars have not ended as fast as we would like, but the next time Congress takes up the issue, do you want John Boehner setting the parameters for debate? Do we want Elizabeth Warren to lead a new consumer protection agency? If the Republicans control Congress, there won't be an agency for her to lead. The insurgent leaders, the Republican bastards, support the banks, even though they spout their populist rhetoric against them. Of course. I mean, this is the part that is crazy producing. There's not a teabagger out there who is not a whore, an absolute get-down, funky street whore, no offense to sex workers, to the capitalist power structure in this country. Not one. We'll be right back.
Well, this is evident, yeah. And the American way, you must get.
Just a little bit. I don't want you to misunderstand the way, and a couple of you already have, I've noticed by the emails here, I don't want you to misunderstand how Scott Galindis is using the term insurgent in relating these teabag freaks to insurgents in Iraq and Afghanistan. He is being very ironic, Scott Galindis is. He even says, I intend to use the word insurgent in the same negative light that the warmongers in this country use it to describe the people of Afghanistan and Iraq who are fighting for their freedom. In other words, what Scott Galindis is saying, that people who are fighting for freedom in those countries are described in this country as insurgents, as though they're going against in an improper way the occupation of their country. All of us would take up weapons in this country if we were occupied. Scott then uses it ironically where it concerns these teabag bastards in this country. They are insurgents, and I think Scott is getting his too twisted here for the average quick reader to follow. What he's trying to say is that the insurgents in Iraq and Afghanistan are not that at all. The insurgents here are not insurgents either, but in a different sense. The insurgents here are paid operatives of capitalism and the warmongers. Now, either you get that or you don't, but he's off on the emails about, well, that's a terrible comparison to make to the Freedom Fund. That's not what he meant. But it's hard to follow this stuff, okay? He goes on to say, do we want people all over America stopped by police because they look Latin and might be here illegally? The insurgents do. Do we want gays and lesbians continue to be discriminated against both while serving our country in the military and when trying to start a family with a loved one? The insurgents do. Do we want our children to continue to be bullied for being gay or brown or black? The insurgents do. Do we want sick people to lose their health insurance or be denied coverage altogether because of pre-existing conditions? The insurgents want that. Do we want women to make less money than men for the same work? The insurgents do. The insurgents, their right-wing husbands wish they were still at home barefoot and pregnant. Do we want Muslims or anyone who looks like a Muslim, whatever that means, to live in fear? The insurgents do. Do we want to abandon the unemployed who struggle to find work while the companies that we bailed out make huge profits? The insurgent leaders do. Scott says, I could go on and on. I urge you to add to this list. No, I'm not saying that all the insurgents are bad people, but they are being led and used by people who do not have their best interests at heart. The Rush Limbaughs, Glenn Becks, and Sarah Palins of the world want us to turn back the clock. The Democrats have a long way to go, and many of them continue to be part of the problem. But if we let the so-called insurgents return to power, things will only get worse. Say no to the Republicans on November 2nd, and then turn the heat up on the Democrats on November 3rd. Now, that's Scott Galindez's opinion. He is the co-founder of Truth Out. You know my opinion. My opinion pretty much is along the lines. I'm not saying it's in perfect alignment because I don't want to attribute to Brad Friedman something he doesn't believe in. But my feeling are along the lines of Brad Friedman's, and that is that our system of electing people with voting machines has been so corrupted and so owned by the capitalist religious freak right that the whole idea of voting has become an exercise in, if not comedy, certainly futility. So you have to decide what you want to do, right? Is everybody familiar with John Maynard Keynes? Huh? At least a passing familiarity, like I have. You know, I can't tell you that much about him. I know he was an economist around the turn of the 19th century. A British economist. His ideas have deeply affected the theory and application and practice of modern macroeconomics, as well as economic policies of governments for a long time, especially as it applies to capitalism. I mean, almost exclusively. John Maynard Keynes was not a socialist. But he had some ideas about how you reverse the negative effects of capitalism, like recessions and these meltdowns that happen with increasing frequency as resources run out, labor markets are getting to the point where there's no place else to go any longer to get to hire people for 10 cents an hour, and slavery is out the window. So Keynesian policy, economic policy, is starting to fall apart, not because Keynes necessarily had things wrong within the capitalist framework, but because, and especially in Europe, Keynesian philosophy is being abandoned. And One of the things he talked about was, in a time of recession, to hell with deficits, spend. The government has got to spend enormous amounts of money to get the economy started up again. This is one of the many weak points in capitalism for us common folk. Now, keep in mind, the rich people never lose. The rich capitalists never lose. And we hear stories, oh, my stock portfolio was reduced by 80%. That doesn't mean anything. It means nothing. Absolutely nothing. When we come back, I'm going to make an attempt at this, because what's going on in Europe could be a precursor to what's going to happen in this country. The only difference is we have a bunch of lying, cowardly bastards, i.e. Republicans and teabaggers, who refuse to deal with the truth. Which is not a revelation, you know that already. But I think you'll find this interesting. Stay with us. Quickly, in much of Europe, where John Maynard Keynes' birthplace, although it was England where he was born, his view, the Keynesian view, that deficit spending by governments is crucial to avoiding a long recession and possibly even a depression, has lately been willfully ignored. The governments of Europe are not going along with this, and as a result, there's all kinds of unrest that is occurring. If you've been following the riots in Paris, or in France, not just Paris, but across France, you've seen some visual representation of what's going on. Now, you have to keep in mind, again, keep this in the framework that I intend it to be in. All of this is about saving capitalism. I think capitalism should be destroyed. But within the context of saving capitalism, the teabaggers in this country are ignorant, cowardly liars. And what they are proposing in order to get elected is nothing but nonsense. Let me go back to Europe. yesterday in Britain, George Osborne, who is the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, like our Secretary of the Treasury, delivered a speech that would have made Keynes, who himself worked in the British Treasury, I found out, blanch. That's not a woman's name from Tennessee Williams' story. Blanch means go white, no matter what color you are, and almost lose it. Why? Because George Osborne argued forcefully that Britons, despite slowing growth and negligible bank lending, Britons must accept a rise in the retirement age to 66 from 65, $130 billion in spending cuts that would eliminate nearly 500,000 public sector jobs and hit pensioners and the poor and the military and the middle class because of what the Chancellor of the Exchequer insisted was the overwhelming need to reduce the country's huge budget deficit. In Ireland, where the economy is suffering through its third consecutive year of economic destruction, Keynes is doing no better. Devastated by historic property crash and banking bust, the Irish government is preparing another round of spending cuts and tax increases. Now, what I'm trying to get to here, in all of these countries, not only are they cutting spending that is going to hammer the working class, part of the middle class, certainly the working poor, not only are they making the cuts, but they're also raising taxes. Now, again, keep in mind, this is to save capitalism. In this country, these filthy, ignorant sons of bitches who identify themselves as teabaggers or Republicans or whatever kind of swine they want to identify themselves, they insist that there's a socialist in the White House and they are here riding in on white horses to save America, save capitalism from the socialist in the White House. These bastards wouldn't know a socialist if one came up and bit them on the throat. But then again, teabaggers are horrendously ignorant. Combined with what the Irish government has already imposed, the cuts that are being proposed there could add up to as much as 14% of Ireland's gross domestic product. An extraordinary amount for a modern industrial country. Ireland's budget deficit reached a third of total economic output this year. Indeed, across Europe, where the threat of a double-dip recession remains palpable, governments from Germany to Greece are slashing public spending. Now, this is totally contrary to John Maynard Keynes, that these right-wing capitalist bastards have sworn by for the past 75, 80, 100 years. But even as students and workers in France battle with the police, the debate in Europe is more on how fast to cut government spending rather than whether such reductions are the right thing to do under the circumstances. Brad DeLong, a liberal economist and blogger at the University of California, Berkeley, said mournfully, quote, "Everything Keynes established about the primacy of maintaining demand at a steady pace is gone." Mr. DeLong added, quote, "Europe obviously thinks it can focus on sound finances while the U.S. manages world demand. But unfortunately, we're not doing that," end quote. Joe Stiglitz, the economist, argued that the British government's plan was, quote, "a gamble with almost no potential upside," and that it would lead to lower growth, lower demand, lower tax revenue, a deterioration of skills among the unemployed, and an even higher national debt. Stiglitz wrote in The Guardian, quote, "We cannot afford austerity." You get it? DeLong and others on the left have long argued for more stimulus spending in the United States and abroad to lift growth, even if deficits rise as a consequence. Now, the point of all this is the fraud that's being perpetrated on the American public by these teabag bastards. Again, you've got to assume, first of all, that capitalism is worth saving, which I don't agree with. Secondly, you've got to assume that the electoral process in this country is uncorrupted, which is nonsense. So if you're willing to make yourself crazy and accept those two assumptions, then fine, let's continue the discussion. Now, Peter Beinart is a senior political writer at the Daily Beast, associate professor of journalism and political science at City University of New York, and a senior fellow at New America Foundation. His new book, The Icarus Syndrome, A History of American Hubris, is out. And he writes, "The British just showed how real conservatives behave, and the biggest cuts in government spending since World War II. He writes, this fall, a group of kamikaze conservatives, terrified by mounting debt, outraged by excessive government spending, and unafraid of hard truths, are rallying to save their children and grandchildren from a future mortgage to the Central Bank of China. Too bad they live in England. He writes, I have my philosophical differences with British Prime Minister David Cameron, but given this, he is what he says he is, a man who hates debt. His new budget, unveiled this week, cuts government spending by a whopping $130 billion over the next 5 years. He's proposed brutal cuts in pensions, welfare, and government employment. And more remarkably, for a conservative, he also wants to cut the defense budget by 8%, raise both value-added and capital gains taxes. To cut the deficit, he's transgressing the ideological taboos of both left and right. He's even slashed funding for the upkeep of the palaces of the Queen. The contrast with our supposed deficit haters in the Republican Party could not be starker. All right, I'm not going to get any further into it. Needless to say, Peter Beinart, writing at the Daily Beast, if you want to read the rest of it, go to the website and check it out. But the point that he's trying to make, and again, this is all presupposed that you think capitalism is a system worth keeping. And you think that the electoral process in this country is still workable, that it still results in the will of the people being expressed on election day. If you're willing to delude yourself on both of those counts, then what Peter Beinart and the rest of these people are writing is true. If you're really going to be a conservative and you're going to cut spending to get the deficit under control, then you've got to raise taxes also. If you do the spending cuts and not the tax raise, you're a liar. You're a son of a bitch. You're frauding the American people. And that is exactly across the board what these teabaggers are doing. Some good news if you live on the Gulf Coast of the United States. According to the Tampa Bay Business Journal, Chevron is going to spend $7.5 billion to set up a new oil and gas project 280 miles south of New Orleans, slam in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. According to geologists for Chevron, this project could have enough oil and gas to keep producing for 3 or 4 decades. Chevron hopes to start producing in 2014, despite delays from political fallout after the BP disaster. 7 test wells have been drilled since 2003 in the two fields, which are 25 miles apart. The ocean there is well over a mile deep, 7,000 feet deep. And getting to the oil and gas won't be easy because it's about 4 more miles down under the seabed. So, anyway, Chevron and its partners on the project will build 3 sets of pumping equipment on the bottom of the sea. And then send everything they suck up to a single production hub. So, there you go. Da, 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 da. Boy, wait till that one blows, huh? Oh, that won't happen, Mike. Jesus God, capitalism takes care. You know, they ram-a-dam-a-ding-dong. Joe Miller, the guy who wants to be a senator from from Alaska. Boy, is this guy a fascist, huh? I mean, there's no question about this guy. This guy is really out there. His bodyguards handcuffed and placed under arrest, quote, a reporter who was trying to cover a town hall meeting last Sunday at Central Middle School in Anchorage. And according to Joe Miller is a goddamn liar. He is a liar. In addition to being a fascist, he's a liar. Here's your proof. Joe Miller said he was required to bring a security detail to the town hall meeting Sunday at Central Middle School. That's what he told two national cable news networks Monday in the wake of the arrest by a security squad of an online journalist at his public event. He told both CNN and Fox he was required, but the school district said there was no such requirement made of Miller. Nothing. He is a filthy liar. All he had to do to provide a hall and parking lot monitor, maybe a school teacher, and to advise participants of school district courtesy and the food rules. Now, the security squad he brought were active duty soldiers, United States military. You don't think fascism is here? The private guards working for Joe Miller, who forcibly detained handcuffed journalists as the journalist tried to ask the candidate questions, which he didn't want to answer, were, the Alaska Dispatch's Tony Hoffinger. He was handcuffed, surrounded by Miller's guards. The story became much worse yesterday when video was released that was taken by a reporter from the Anchorage Daily News showing that these guards threatened at least two other reporters with physical detention as they tried to find out what happened. The guards, quote, demanded that they leave or else be handcuffed, and the guards physically blocked them from filming the incident, all while threatening to physically remove them from the event, which was a public event. Now, the guards are all employed by something called the Drop Zone. It's a neo-fascist organization like Blackwater. And the guards are active duty soldiers. They were dressed in blazers and ties and wore radio pieces in their ears. They refused to give their names, say who they worked for, or cite the authority under which they were issuing commands to reporters. And now it turns out that they were active duty military. The Army allows off-duty soldiers to take outside employment if the job doesn't interfere with their readiness, doesn't risk their own injury, and doesn't negatively affect the, quote, good order, end quote, and discipline of their unit. The soldiers are Specialist Tyler Ellingbo, who's 22, Sergeant Alexander Valdez, who's 31. They're assigned to the 3rd Maneuver Enhancement Brigade at Fort Richardson in Alaska. Major Bill Coppernoll is the public affairs officer for the Army in Alaska, and we have a comment from him when we come back. And they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. So if you meet with these historians, I'll tell you what to say. Tell them that the Nazis never really went away. They're out there burning houses down and peddling racist lies. And we'll never rest again. It's good news week. Families shake the need for coal by stimulating birth control. We're wanting less to eat. It's good news week. Doctors
he watches C-SPAN so you don't have to. It's more Mike Malone.
It is 25 before the hour. So, these two soldiers, Specialist Tyler Ellingbo and Sergeant Alexander Valdez, are assigned to the 3rd Maneuver Enhancement Brigade at Fort Richardson, Alaska. Major Bill Coppernall, who is the public affairs officer for the Army in Alaska, said the two soldiers did not have permission from their current chain of command to work for something called the drop zone. Now, the drop zone is Joe Miller's security contractor, combination surplus store, Army surplus store, and protection service, probably a gas station and a place where you can get your oil changed, too. You know, Jesus Christ. Unbelievable. Anyway, according to the public affairs officer for the Army, they didn't have permission to work for the drop zone. The Army is still researching whether previous company or brigade commanders authorized their employment. But the head of Major Coppernall, the public affairs officer, said, quote, they've got to be up front with the chain of command. The chain of command needs to agree they can do that without affecting the readiness and the whole crew of things, a whole slew of things that are part of being a soldier that they need to do first. Oh, really? Miller's chief guard at the middle school event, middle school, drop zone owner William Fulton. He said it wasn't his job to ensure soldiers complied with the regulations. He said, quote, they're adults, they're responsible for themselves. Mr. Fulton said the soldiers called him Monday after this occurred on Sunday and said they might be in trouble. I don't understand why this isn't getting more attention from so-called mainstream media. I really don't. Either the Alaska Daily News or the Anchorage Daily News, I can never tell because they both use ADN. I guess it really doesn't matter. And a media operation in Alaska reports that only was Joe Miller's excuse for why he hired the private guards a lie. It raises questions. Was Joe Miller required to bring a security detail to his town hall meeting at this middle school? That's what Miller told two national cable news networks Monday. But it's a lie. It's a lie. The school said there was no such requirement made of Miller. The school spokesperson said, we do not require users to hire security. If you're not concerned that active duty members of the military can put people under some form of arrest, whether it's citizen's arrest or military detention, because that citizen happens to be a journalist and that citizen was asking questions. Now, remember what the modus operandi of agreed to, apparently, by all of these teabag bastards. They don't answer questions because every time they open their mouth, you know, Christine O'Donnell is still wandering around telling, I think it was ABC or NBC this morning, that the other night when she made a big deal about trying to back her opponent Coons down on the issue of whether or not the First Amendment issues an injunction against combining church and state, she still believes that when the audience started laughing, they were laughing because she caught Coons. I mean, she went on national television yesterday and said it again. I've never seen such a collection of morons. But people like Joe Miller and Palladino and some of those people really have no problem like using fascist tactics. Like Miller said, as far as keeping immigrants out of this country, East Germany managed to do it. I mean, what a stupid son of a bitch Miller is. What East Germany did was kept people from fleeing away from the kind of government that Joe Miller would establish, totalitarianism, backed by the military. Joe Miller has got to be stupider than Christine O'Donnell. Is that her name, O'Donnell? He's got to be stupider. In addition to being, I mean, what's with the unshaven look? Come on, Joe, who do you think you are? I mean, what do you think you are, some Rambo movie star freak? Jesus, what a jerk. So what Joe Miller is saying, it should be easy to keep people out of the country. Look how these Germans did it. Now, if you suggested to this dumb bastard that these German secret police, the Stasi, that apparently has no problem hiring, he hires military to act as police for him. If someone were to point out to this dumb punk of stupidity that the reason the security from East Germany to West worked, first of all, people were fleeing away from the kind of government Joe Miller would establish, but the way the East Germans handled it, they shot them dead, you dumbass. That's why it worked. I mean, who are these people? Where do these scum-sucking right-wingers come from? Get out of my country, you bastards. And you know what? They're going to win on November 2nd. Sharon Angle didn't show up at a huge Tea Party Express rally in Las Vegas last night, Tuesday night. She doesn't make public appearances anymore. But the event was almost entirely in support of her and the divisive platform she has promoting her ascendancy to replace Senator Harry Reid. According to the New York Times, there was a folk song praising Arizona for its immigration crackdown. And the featured speaker was Joe Arpaio of Maricopa County, Arizona. The guy who marches, among other things, he marches illegal immigrants through the streets of Phoenix to tent jails in the broiling desert. Arpaio is another Nazi, another fascist, and loves it. Every time somebody calls him a fascist, he has a sexual response. He loves it. He loves it. Ms. Angle said last week that every state should have a sheriff like Joe Arpaio. And he returned the compliment in his own particular chilling way. He said, quote, you guys have got a desert here, he told the cheering, foot-stomping crowd. Why don't you put up some tents? End quote. The laughter of his audience, according to the New York Times, of about 2,000 people, mostly wearing free Angle T-shirts or buttons, practically shook the walls of Stoney's Rockin' Country Nightclub, where handheld signs proclaim Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, to be a traitor, a socialist, and garbage. Harry Reid is a lot of things, most of which are ineffective, but a socialist? A traitor? Harry Reid's campaign, according to the Times, had once looked forward to running against Ms. Angle, figuring that her extreme positions would quickly marginalize her in the minds of voters. But, it is a big but, right, Harry? He somehow failed to recognize just how attractive those positions would be in a state with the nation's highest unemployment rate and highest rates of foreclosure and bankruptcy. See, isn't that what usually happens? Is that, I hate to use the German model again, but isn't that what happened in Germany in the 20s and 30s as a result of the reparations and the horrors that were visited upon the German people by the Treaty of Versailles after World War I, the end of World War I, and then the global depression? And it gave rise to Hitler, Joe Miller, Sharon Angle, brown shirts, Joe Miller's security detention. You know, this is how it works. Wow. There's a strong chance that Sharon Angle is going to become a United States senator. And she will have done so, according to the New York Times, by exploiting fears of illegal Hispanic immigrants in an economically nervous state. She told a group of Hispanic students a few days ago, when she didn't realize she was being recorded, that the people in her ad, she's got an ad that shows dark-skinned characters sneaking along a border fence, and there's a Mexican flag. And she told these kids that those people were not necessarily Hispanic. She said they might have been coming through the Canadian border. She called the Canadian border, quote, the most porous border that we have, and added that, quote, this is where the terrorists come through, Canada. The Canadian ambassador immediately protested this nonsense. Jesus Christ. She's willing to persist in her illusion that Social Security can be fixed only by turning it over to private accounts. And this is the reason I hope these right-wing bastards do take over the House and the Senate. I want every single putrid, nasty teabagger, and they're all over the age of 60, I want every one of these morons to have a real sense of panic and terror when the woman they put in decides to lead the charge to end their pensions and Social Security. Oh, I want to see that happen. It's about 10 before the hour. Well, that was interesting. I just went to the chat room on the Ustream. If you're not Ustreaming, why not? I want to go back to this Ginny Thomas thing that we talked about Tuesday night, and then replayed the program last night when we went to Molly's school function. Susie Parker, writing at Politics Daily, says Virginia Thomas has become increasingly more active in Washington's conservative political circles. Last year, she founded Liberty Central. With the goal of preserving liberty and citizens' choices. Jesus Christ, why is that the language that's used when liberty has nothing to do with it and citizens' voices, choices, whatever, has absolutely nothing to do with the agenda of these freaks? Liberty Central frequently targets Obama's tyranny. Now, I disagree with Obama on a couple of things, but where was this drunk Ginny Thomas when the Bush crime family was destroying the country? When George Bush referred to the U.S. Constitution as a goddamn piece of paper? Where was this holier-than-thou twit Ginny Thomas then? You see? So, again, anything these right-wingers say is garbage. Garbage. Nonsense. Her website, the website Liberty Central, Jesus God, says, quote, Ginny recognized the need for our country to bridge the gap between our nation's citizens and its capital and return to a government that adheres to our core founding principles, limited government, personal responsibility, individual liberty, free enterprise, and national security. End quote. She's described on the site as its president and CEO. Her bio talks about her work in the past with, quote, esteemed politicians like Dick Armey and for institutions like Hillsdale College. You know what that is? That's that nest of religious crazy people in Michigan. I mean, just demons. Every one of them. demons, of course, are an invention. Hell is an invention of the Christians. And this Hillsdale College turns these bastards out. I mean, really sick people. She also talks about the Heritage Foundation and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. That is poisoning what's left of our electoral system. But Ginny Thomas doesn't give a goddamn. She's a fascist, in addition to being a drunk. Calling up Anita Hill, 7:30 in the morning. Oh, Anita, I think it's about time. Listen, I'm just trying to reach out and extend an olive branch. I want to stick in your goddamn eye, but I just, this is Ginny Thomas. You didn't get him. I did. And I'm white. She says that she's a fan of Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levine, and Laura Ingraham. And it goes on to say, quote, she's intrigued by Glenn Beck and listens carefully. She also enjoys motorhoming. What is that, riding around in a trailer? Motorhoming and watching 24. Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. There's no mention of her husband. Oh, my God. In his 2007 autobiography, Uncle Clarence Thomas called Anita Hill, quote, my most traitorous adversary. Traitorous. Traitors. This is the part that drives me just absolutely crazy. These sons of bitches who are destroying the United States of America, destroying our system of self-government, they have the audacity to call Anita Hill, this thug, this punk, this Uncle Clarence, calls Anita Hill traitorous. They refer to Harry Reid as a socialist. This woman, this Ginny, refers to Barack Obama as a tyrant? Well, I mean, George Orwell warned about this, and here we are. Back in 2007, Anita Hill wrote an op-ed for the New York Times. She said about Uncle Clarence, she would not allow him or his anger, in his book, calling her a traitorous adversary, she would not allow him or his anger to reinvent her. He described her in his book as a combative left-winger who was touchy and prone to overreacting to slights, like grabbing her ass, Uncle Clarence, talking about long dong silver, Uncle Clarence. Huh? Making those sexual innuendos while your old lady's at home thinking about putting together something called Liberty Central! I wonder if Clarence and Ginny sit around and talk about Anita, or if Uncle Clarence just goes to bed and then Ginny gets out the gin. Starts throwing it back, passes out on the living room couch, and wakes up at 7 o'clock and says, God damn, I think I'm going to call Anita Hill. Where's my phone? Give me my goddamn phone. I'm going to leave that bitch a message. That's what I'm going to do. You suppose? It's 6:30 past the hour. The other night, I was talking about Russ Feingold, who is running for, what, his fifth or sixth term in the Senate. And he has an opponent named Johnson. Let me share something with you that came in from Joe in Oxford, Wisconsin. Joe writes, Mike, I'm putting in long hours working for Senator Feingold's reelection here in Wisconsin, so I just heard last Wednesday's podcast in which you talked about Johnson's challenge, and I thank you for that. If, however, you knew the real story behind Johnson's inspiration to run, it would turn even your well-seasoned stomach into knots. In January of this year, Mr. Johnson testified before a Wisconsin State Senate committee regarding the proposed child victims law. This legislation in Wisconsin would have lifted the statute of limitations on prosecuting child molesters and their protectors. Victims of child molestation, child advocacy organizations, clergy, and a police chief all testified in favor of this bill. Mr. Johnson testified in opposition, citing what he called economic havoc as the reason for his opposition. This corporatist pig sought financial asylum for, quote, private organizations, quote, employers of a perpetrator, quote, churches, quote, any organization that relies on fundraising, and, quote, big pots of money. He wanted those people to be exempt, yet never mentioned a safe place for children who have been or who are to be sexually abused. Astonishingly, Mr. Johnson was at that time a financial advisor to a tentacle of one of the biggest pots of money in the world, a church which relies on fundraising, and an employer of perpetrators of child sexual abuse, the Catholic Diocese of Green Bay, Wisconsin. The Green Bay Diocese is well known around here as ground zero for child molestation in Wisconsin, and was the impetus behind the legislature trying to lift the statute. For decades, a Green Bay Diocese priest named Feeney sexually molested children throughout the north, throughout northeast Wisconsin, while his bishop, Morneau, sent him from parish to parish at least 14 times to feast on the innocence of fresh batches of children. And then finally to Nevada, where Feeney continued to satisfy his perverse sexual appetite. Feeney is now in jail, but only as a result of prosecution in Nevada. However, his superior, Morneau, remains free to protect the other child molesters in his charge because of Wisconsin's statute of limitations, which Johnson, Senator Feingold's opponent, self-described as a, quote, confirmed Lutheran, end quote, has now helped to preserve. The fact that Johnson was, at the time of his testimony, a member of the Finance Council of the Diocese of Green Bay, and even stated so on his written testimony, was never raised as a conflict of interest by the committee or anyone else, except when a June article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel appeared and then died a quick, media yawning death. The ease with which this reptilian corporatist slithered through these proceedings and preyed upon legislation every good parent in Wisconsin would support without the taint of conflict clinging to his scales may very well be what inspired him to his current political aspirations. But this story cannot seem to get any media traction, and Senator Feingold must consider even touching it grounds for accusations of mudslinging. So Johnson slithers on, untouched by the reality that he chose his own business interests over children robbed of their innocence and of their childhood. If he has no compassion whatsoever for children, woe unto the rest of Wisconsinites and this nation should he buy his way into a U.S. Senate seat. Here's some excerpts from Johnson's testimony. Quote, I think it is extremely important to consider the economic havoc and other victims it would likely create, the child victims law. Quote, it is obvious that any lawsuits under this bill would be directed at private organizations, end quote. Quote, I believe it is a valid question to ask whether the employer of a perpetrator should also be severely damaged, end quote. Quote, I simply don't see the big pots of money available that this bill must assume exist, end quote. He means in terms of lawsuits. You filthy son of a bitch. Quote, any organization that relies on fundraising would suffer as this would make their fundraising efforts significantly more difficult, end quote. What he means is if they have a child molester or two or 20 employed. And last, quote, I urge you to defeat this legislation, end quote. And Joe signs off, I wished I believed in hell right now. Yeah, this is so typical. I mean, the teabaggers, the right-wingers, the Republicans, I've said this for a decade, if not longer, they're anti-family. They hate women. Oh, my God, they just want to either, you know, women are either maids or whores, as far as they're concerned, period. There's no halfway ground for these bastards. They hate women. They despise even their own children, as evidenced by the laws that they would put into effect. They are religious fanatics who believe in the kind of religion that is vile, bloody, putrid, death-dealing, and disgusting. They hate America. What motivates them is a kind of greedy narcissism that I don't know what it takes to be satisfied. I guess to be a United States senator. And then you have Russ Feingold, with whom I, in particular, I mean, since I'm talking about him, I disagree with several of his positions. I disagree with his overall position where it concerns the state of Israel. But that's one of the few. There are a couple more. But what do you want? What do you people in Wisconsin want? Seriously. Do you want some piece of toilet goo named Johnson? Or do you want to continue with a decent, good man, Russ Feingold? Have I mentioned yet tonight how much I hate these right-wingers? I guess I mention that with every sentence, don't I? Oh, yeah, Jenny Thomas, the drunk wife of this useless Supreme Court Justice, Uncle Clarence. Jenny, when I heard about this phone call to Anita Hill, I just had this flash on Martha Mitchell. Any of you remember Martha Mitchell? This goes back to Watergate days, so not a lot of you would know what the hell I'm talking about, except as an historical event. But at the height of all the crap going on in Washington, Martha Mitchell, I'm talking about the Nixon criminality. Martha Mitchell, who was the wife of Nixon's Attorney General, John Mitchell. Martha Mitchell was a drunk also, and she freely admitted it. She wasn't a holier-than-thou, hypocritical freak like Jenny Thomas. But Martha Mitchell would get on the phone at midnight, 2, 3, 4 in the morning, and she would call newspaper reporters around the city for the Washington Post. She would call the New York Times. She would call people up, and she would say things. As far as I'm concerned, Martha Mitchell was deep throat. I think Jenny's deep throat, too, but I mean that in a different way. Martha Mitchell was deep throat. And she would call reporters, drunk on her ass, and she would say, you don't know what's going on here. They're destroying the Constitution. My husband's involved in it. It's all illegal. And she would go on and on and on. Now, the problem is, when she would sober up then the next day, and she would get a call back from the reporter, and she would say, oh, my God, did I say that? Oh, well, I didn't really mean that. And, of course, some of it made its way into print. Poor Martha Mitchell, I think eventually she was sent to a place to dry out or something. But when I heard about Jenny Thomas, it just reminded me of poor old Martha Mitchell.
here it is. Back to Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. I just can't get over Christine O'Donnell thinking that she really scored on her Democratic opponent the other night in that debate in Delaware when she thought she was mocking Mr. Coons because he said the First Amendment contains the separation clause, separation of church and state. Why bother? All right. We're taking phone calls, by the way, if you want to call in. 877-996-2556. Steve is in Burbank, California. Hey, Steve.
Hiya, Mikey.
Hey.
Well, you know, I wouldn't try to judge people too harshly who have a few drinks before making phone calls. Sorry about that. But anyway, I thought
if they're fascist, if they're calling up somebody and demanding that that somebody, Anita Hill, apologize for telling the truth, what are you kidding
yeah.
me? Come on, you know.
I demand that you apologize to me because you were saying good things about TARP until I finally found out where you were coming from.
Right.
And I blogged that, you know, picture the Monopoly guy. He picks up the card and says, bank errors in your favor.
Right.
Get Congress to extort $700 billion from the taxpayers.
Right.
And that is the model that we're in. That's the box. That's what you talked about later, which qualified what you were talking about.
Right.
It is our belief that somehow that all life and all existence flows out of this little green printed stuff, you know, little pieces of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And in the I'm rereading again the Illuminati papers, and it's on page 25. It's Hagbard Salim called Neuroeconomics, and it explains psychologically how money has been taken to transfer your biosurvival instincts into an abstract concept to be accepted as reality. I don't know if that sounds too crazy or too far out, but I can understand it, and I wish, Mikey, that we had more time to talk about it.
Oh, well, maybe someday. Maybe in the afterlife, eh, Steve?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, a lot of people are talking about the, you know, how we believe, and, you know, I came up with this little label called the societal belief syndrome.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like a chronic affliction that has gone on since before recorded history. I think it started with the shamans, you know, when they said, well, I can make this seed grow and that one not, you know, and the rest of the tribe believed them and said, oh, you know more than us, you're smarter than us. And so they believed everything he said. And he came up with stuff like, well, you know, don't mess around with my teenage daughter or else the great sky spook will come and make your life miserable. Or else they would come to him and say, well, how come the crowds failed? You said they would be good, you know. And he said, well, it wasn't me that did it. There's one more powerful than me, and he's invisible, and he's the one that says what things are. He's the one that says the clouds rain and all that stuff. And it's just a scam.
Well,
you know, it's just a scam right from the top.
I think so. I think it is.
And a good cartoon for somebody to put out, you know, I've been trying to get an artist to maybe do this, but I offend every artist that I know. It's like, here you have people, you know, here's a dead guy in a grave. It's like a hunter-gatherer society, you know, and people are throwing flowers in it. And they're saying, we like oog. We not want oog to smell bad, you know, because this is the thrown flowers, you know, and they know that death is not that good of a thing to smell. And there's some scam artist standing up, maybe I can cash in on this somehow.
Right.
First must invent money. And Jack Rutherford wrote a thing called The History of Money.
Yeah.
And he said that, I don't know if it was 3,000 years ago or 3,000 B.C. when money came into existence, but the way that it came to be was that the invaders, the overwhelming power structure, decided this is the way we're going to do it. No more of this bartering. No more being a community. No more getting along with each other. We we tell you that this is how it's going to be. We'll take these little gold nuggets, we'll stamp things on them, you know, and we'll call it money. And they said it's through the artificial construction of the power of the state that says you're going to go by this system or we will kill you.
Well, that doesn't seem like people had too much of a choice. Hey, Steve, I got to leave it there. We're about 10 seconds away from a break. Thanks for checking in. When we come back from this break, I have a kind of a report card from Kay Petrini, our education affairs correspondent. She doesn't mention education unless you come at this from a position that everything Kay writes about is education, right? Okay, we'll do that when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
I had the money changers out of the temple. I had bank, just that simple. Gold crown, Tommy Ted is a better thing to keep the money in. Mason jar is okay too. If you see your bank, well, you know what to do. Now, let me tell you people something. Only banks I like Ernie Banks, all right. And I like the banks of the Mississippi River. And I like banks of Fender Twin Reverb. Well, when I walk in there, treat me like a dog, gonna hit him in the head with the doo-doo law. Republicans, one and all, their tallywhackers are not his fault.
You know if you...
Renegade Talk Radio done right. From the left, it's Mike Malloy.
It's coming through a hole in the air. From those nads, Tiananmen Square. It's coming from
25 before the hour.
This ain't exactly
all right, I'm coming to your calls here in a minute. First, I'm going to get this email from Kay Petrini. She writes, Mike, on Tuesday's show, you spent quite a bit of time talking about the march this country is taking toward fascism. I spent Tuesday at a seminar sponsored by the Bill of Rights Institute. We were treated to practical strategies for our classrooms and also three outstanding lectures on our founding documents, Common Sense, the Declaration, and the Constitution, held by a professor from one of our local universities. Throughout the day, I couldn't help but draw parallels between then and now, and my hope was to go home and write them up into a report card. But you know what? My intellectual energy is at an all-time low these days, probably from trying to keep up with a six-month-old puppy. Let me digress. No, Kay, it's not from the puppy. I know exactly what you feel. Back to Kay's email. So any kind of profound observations will have to wait until this weekend after I get some sleep. Let me digress again. Kay, that doesn't work. You can get all the sleep you want. As long as you think about what is happening to our country, you're going to stay in the state of fatigue. Anyway, she goes on. In the meantime, I wanted to share something a bit more mundane but still relevant to the subject of this country's movement toward fascism. Last weekend, several friends and I ran the Nike Women's Marathon here in the city being San Francisco. Okay, so they ran the marathon, I ran the half marathon. The entry fee for this race is on the pricey side, so my friends were upset that Nike cut some serious corners at the finish line. The next day, John Bingham, a columnist for Runner's World magazine, echoed my friend's sentiments when he published a critical review of the race. This is part of what he wrote, How Not to Run a Race. Congratulations to everyone who completed the 2010 Nike Women's Marathon and Half Marathon this weekend. It was, in many ways, a very difficult day, and anyone who crossed the finish line deserves a lot of credit, which is why what happened at the end of the race is so upsetting. I don't want to go off on a rant, but I can't keep silent. What I witnessed on Sunday was the single most cruel, heartless, and outrageous display of, well, I don't even know what to call it, inappropriate behavior by a race organizer that I've ever seen. With 20 minutes to go before the published close of the event, a time that the announcer was counting down, some cowboy-headed jerk decided that the race was over. He turned off the sound, stopped the clock, and literally tore the banners off the finish line structure. worse, those who finished after the premature closure were denied the finisher's necklace. Shame on anyone and everyone who allowed that to happen. Shame on Nike. Shame on the finish line operations crew. And shame on the cowboy hat a clown for being such a jerk. End quote. Kay continues, well, guess what happened? Within a few hours of Bingham publishing his column, it was removed from the website. I was able to find a cached version of it. Who do you think had the power to silence a critic of a race run by such a well-known sponsor, Nike? Could it have been Nike itself? Whether it was indeed Nike or another of the race's corporate co-sponsors, one thing is certain. Corporations do not like it when pipsqueak journalists call them out. And if the pipsqueak is a sports journalist, well, he's that much easier to shut down. All Nike has to do is threaten to pull its ubiquitous ads from his magazine. I realize that this is a relatively minor incident involving the sporting arena, but to me, it is a glaring example of how corporatism has slowly become the law of the land. I started noticing it back when our beloved Candlestick Park, home of the 49ers, was dubbed 3Com Park after the naming rights had been sold. Our baseball park has been through several name changes from Pac Bell to SBC to AT&T. Did I mention Go Giants? Soon, this same corporate naming phenomenon started to show up in road races. The famous San Francisco Beta Breakers became the ING Beta Breakers. Same with the Chicago Marathon. And the last time I tried to look up the showtime for a movie at the Empire Theater, I couldn't find any listings. I knew that the theater was still there because I frequently walked past it, so why couldn't I find it? Because it is now listed under the name of its corporate owner, CineArts at the Empire. Sadly, this is the case with almost every movie theater in my area now. Corporate identity has become paramount in this country over the past three decades. When I show my students the attached photo each year, they are immediately able to identify the corporation represented by each logo. Whether they can identify the Vice President of the United States is another matter entirely. In both significant and mundane ways, the march toward corporatism continues to eat away at the fabric of American society. And when we look at the past 30 years collectively, it's clear that the Citizens United ruling simply put the icing on our fascist cake. Kay. You can read her stuff at kaysreportcard.com. K-A-Y-S. kaysreportcard.com. Sanchez is in East L.A. listening online. Hey, Sanchez.
Well, regarding Kay's email right now about Joe Biden, perhaps if he put the Nike logo on his forehead, perhaps her students would then be able to
well, they could get the logo right.
Yeah. Well, I think they will remember the person. It's by association, so, yeah, I think they would remember that. It is so tough following Stephen from Burbank, so after this phone call, I'm going to have a shot of Patron Reposado in his honor.
Okay, you could do that. Go ahead.
Yeah. I wanted to mention something about Martha Mitchell since you were bringing her up.
You can do anything you want.
Well, thank you. I was hearing a story, and I don't know if you know or can verify this, but the night before John Mitchell had her committed to the, whether it was a loony bin or it was an alcoholic center, she supposedly overheard some sort of a plot about bombing the Twin Towers that John Mitchell was discussing with a few of his guests.
Oh, really? Where did you hear that? I never heard that one.
It was supposedly, I attend all of these different types of lectures and meetings, and this was in a videotape of a program that was aired sometime in the late 1980s. I don't know the name of the program, but if you would like, I'll do some research on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you got too many I don't remembers in there, or I'm not sure where is in there. I wouldn't be surprised, Sanchez, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Martha Mitchell tried to warn the whole country as to what was going on inside that nest of perversion called the Nixon White House.
Mm-hmm.
She tried to warn anybody who would listen and everybody, and all she got was mocked and laughed at because of her alcoholism and because of the way she did. Nobody wanted to believe That was the problem. It didn't make any difference if Martha Mitchell was drunk or sober. Nobody wanted to believe what she was saying. It was
right.
It was too over the top. Like, no. They're not doing that, Martha. Now go back to sleep. Go have another drink or whatever. So.
Supposedly after that happened, that weekend that she was committed on, by that Monday morning, she was dead. So that's what this person was saying. But I'll send you the information in an email. I'll do the research here. I'll even check with the person that was showing that particular video to get the exact information for you.
Okay.
Regarding don't ask, don't tell, this is like another accident that I was seeing waiting to happen, you know, the car crashing in front of the brick wall yesterday. And my spidey senses were really up about this. I mean, I could see these poor people getting screwed on this particular incident. For one day, of course, you know that gays were allowed to openly declare, you know, their sexual preference and still be allowed to enlist in the military or continue to be actively serving in the military. And I'd like to use the incident of Lieutenant Daniel Choi. I'm sure you're familiar with him.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. Yesterday,
he famously was applying at the Armed Service or the Recruitment Center in Times Square.
Mm-hmm.
And all the while that I'm listening to the audio of this on NPR, I'm telling him, no, you're going to get screwed, man. Don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So this morning when I saw him on CNN, he was visibly upset, and of course understandably upset. And his comments were in reply to White House advisor Valerie Jarrett's comments. But he was basically saying that the Obama administration is just playing politics before a midterm election, and that he has lost any trust in the Obama administration, and went on to say that basically he will never, ever, ever vote for President Obama again. I honestly, Mike, I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, it was told to a lot of people that this was temporary. I mean, it was very iffy that this was going to hold.
Mm-hmm.
And now I really, really feel sorry for all of these people that have declared openly that they're gay, because now they're in limbo. What
mm-hmm.
happens to these people? I've heard several people today talking about, oh, the law and the procedures and everything else. But so far, to this point, they haven't said a word about what's going to happen to all of these people that have just been recruited or have just announced openly they're gay.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, you're right about Sanchez. You're right about or Choi, Lieutenant Choi is right, I think, about the politics of this as it's manifested by the Obama administration. This could have been ended a long time ago, but Barack Obama has shown himself to be unable to do the things I think that a president is required to do. Sanchez, thanks for checking in. I'll talk to you later. We'll be right back. Contributors. There's a lot of folks who contribute, but on a regular basis with stuff that usually gets read over the air. Sharon Gordy, who is our military affairs correspondent. Bruce Enberg, Prairie 2, Economic Affairs. Kay Petrini, Education Affairs. Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolf, who... I've designated the program's ethics advisors, and, of course, the program's engineer and producers, Kathy Bay. Gordon in Oklahoma City regarding Jenny Thomas. the wife of Uncle Clarence. Gordon writes, Mike, I'm not sure if there's a law prohibiting witness harassment or intimidation whenever one testifies before a congressional committee. Gordon, I think there is. But that is exactly what the wife of Clarence Thomas is doing. It should not make any difference how long in the past the testimony occurred. The fact that the person doing the harassing is doing so in the present revives a cause for action. Just an opinion, Gordon. Yeah, I think intimidation of a federal witness, oh my God. I mean, is there anything that other than, and I think that's a felony, isn't it? I mean, I hadn't even thought about that. But Jenny Thomas, you see, runs Liberty Central, and Clarence probably put the word out to the press. Look, my wife is a drunk. Jesus Christ, what do you want me to do? And Kay Petrini writes, when I played the clip of Christine O'Donnell's idiocy regarding the First Amendment for my government students this morning, their jaws literally dropped. I even heard a few gasps and exclamations of, oh my God. The kids were in total disbelief. So, 17-year-old high school students are able to see O'Donnell's stupidity for what it is. Not millions of adults in this country, but millions of adults in this country apparently are not able to do so. Go figure. The upside was that my students left class today feeling very smart. And Paula writes, Mike, based on what Anita Hill said about his methods, Uncle Clarence's, and I plan on wearing my I Believe Anita t-shirt to work for Casual Friday, I bet old Clarence has been making up stories for years about what he and Anita did, quote, quote. Maybe he tries to make Jenny jealous, or it just turns him on to taunt her about his escapades with other women. And then there's some other stuff here. Carry on, Paula. Thanks, Paula. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that either. That's probably, you know, because you got to wonder why almost 20 years after the fact does Jenny call Anita Hill, and when are you going to apologize for what you said about my husband? So, yeah, Paul's probably right. Probably, you know, when Clarence gets ready for bed at night and he takes off that robe. Ooh, he takes off that robe. I don't know which should be scarier, watching him take off his robe or watching Jenny take off hers. But anyway, when he takes off his robe, he probably says, let me tell you about what Anita and I, well, you know, what I thought about Anita. Yeah, that woman has some ass. I'm serious. She has some serious ass, Jenny. So, you know, no offense, honey, but, you know, you are Caucasian. I mean, that's okay. I mean, I'm married to you. But Anita had some real ass. Just thought I would mention that to you again for the umpteenth time. Is that the song, Baby Got Back? I don't call it back. I call it ass. It's ass. You know, I mean, it's ass. What are you going to do? You know. Tim is in Detroit. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Mike. What a visual to think about.
No, don't go there.
Yeah, it's sort of like reminds me of a bad movie in which George C. Scott played Benito Mussolini within it.
Right.
We're sort of at that place, and in the midst of this, and at the time I'm about to use, it's actually a contradiction in terms. It's what I call fascist chaos.
Now,
the reason that's a contradiction in terms is because anybody who looks at the history of fascism knows that ultimately fascism wants a corporate order.
Oh yeah.
But what they do to secure that is they send out, and of course in Nazi Germany it was the brown shirts.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is you end up intimidating the whole population. You pick out certain target groups. In Germany it was the Jews, and obviously in Italy, the Jews were also suppressed quite a bit. In fact, Enrico Fermi, one of the reasons he had to flee Italy was because of his wife. Mm-hmm. She was Jewish. But in the midst of all this, we're not really talking about, as a society, or for that matter, I don't hear too much even among progressives, the voting machines. They've mm-hmm. been completely rigged now. So we don't even know, you know, if the elections are even going to be legitimate on November 2nd.
I
hear constantly in mainstream media, the polls indicate this and the polls indicate that. And I sit back and I go, really? The people really mm-hmm. believe the Republican Party who destroyed this economy to the point of absurdity. They really want these people back.
That's the part that's maddening to me. And as you know, I'm sure you know this, Tim. One of the people who is consistently on the voting fraud thing. Other people have done it, but the one who's consistently on is Brad Friedman, who substitutes for me occasionally, lucky me. Bradblog.com is his website. And, you know, Greg Palast has put a lot of effort in it, so have a couple other people. But Brad Friedman is the one who consistently tries. He's like Paul Revere. He's trying to warn people that the fascists are coming, and this is how they're doing it. And I don't understand why people are not listening to what he has to say. Tim, I got to leave it there. There's the music. Thanks, man. We'll talk again. We'll talk again, I promise. Yeah, we'll be relying a little bit more on the phones tomorrow, especially. Tomorrow's Friday, so. Thanks for hanging out tonight. I appreciate it. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.